This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, this is The Money. I'm Richard Aidy. Fruit and vegetable inflation, you've probably noticed it. There are reports of cabbages for $9 a head, lettuces for $10 or more. You'll hear why a bit later. How confident are you feeling about your personal finances at the moment? What about the wider economy? These questions are being asked each month to put together the Westpac Melbourne Institute Consumer Sentiment Index, a check-up on how we're feeling about money and what we're doing with it. The latest index has gone down. It's now at 86.4. Bill Evans is Westpac's chief economist. Bill, can you put this in context?
We've had five really serious periods of economic dislocation since the early 80s, being COVID, the global financial crisis, the deep recession of the early 90s, the slowdown of the mid 80s, and then the recession of the early 80s. And the sort of numbers that we've seen on confidence in those periods are comparable with what we've got today. Now, they are lower than they are today, but certainly it's not outside the realm of evidence that that what we're seeing now is comparable with those periods of huge dislocation. The last three, really, the early 80s, mid 80s, early 90s, were associated with high inflation, rising interest rates, and economic contraction. And the other two, of course, were quite different, COVID being quite different. And, of course, the global financial crisis being more a credit-related issue than the other three. But this period at the moment is much more comparable to those first three.
Well, this time, of course, we have rising inflation, rising interest rates now, but not, at the moment, a contracting economy.
No, and we're expecting that we will see a substantial slowdown in growth next year. I think at the moment, obviously, the consumer is always the key driver of the Australian economy. And there are reasons to believe that the consumer spending will hold up pretty well in the next 3 to 6 months. The reopening effect is still very much there. We're seeing that in our high frequency turnover in our credit card and debit card activities. But we also saw in the first quarter when spending was up about $8.5 billion, but $6 billion of that was funded by a fall in the savings rate. So more money was freed up as people saved less. So our savings rate is still 11.6%. We think 6% is the normal level. So there's scope over the course of the next couple of quarters for the savings rate to come down further and that to boost our spending over and above the spending that's financed by normal income. So I think the next couple of quarters will be good, but those factors will fade. Savings rate will head back down to these normal levels, and the reopening effect, of course, will have faded very much by the September quarter.
I would imagine that this latest slump in sentiment was measured before Tuesday evening when the Reserve Bank Governor Philip Lowe said the RBA was expecting inflation to get to 7% by the end of the year. So I'm thinking that's not a factor. But what was this slump driven by?
Well, we ask our respondents what are the key issues that are on their mind, and 60% of them said inflation. Now, the average answer for inflation is about 12%. So there's been a huge spike, and inflation was by far the most dominant issue that our respondents were thinking about. Others were interest rates, of course, the condition of the domestic economy, and very much so the situation overseas. But the dominance of inflation, I think, is the key factor here. It is really starting to impact upon people's confidence.
Your index is, of course, made up of sub-indices like how people feel about their family finances compared to a year ago or the family finances over the next 12 months. As I understand it, that latter one is particularly telling this time.
Yes, that came as a bit of a shock to me. When I looked at, say, the last period of very weak sentiment during the global financial crisis, we found that the numbers for how people feel about their finances relative to a year ago were pretty comparable. But what was different was that back in the GFC, people were much more optimistic about the 12-month outlook for their finances than they are today. And I think it was really linked with the fact that during a GFC, of course, interest rates were getting cut, whereas this time interest rates are being increased. And that's really elevated the degree of uncertainty about how your finances will evolve over the next 12 months.
How do people feel about whether it's time to go and buy something big, an appliance or a car or something like that?
Yeah, that component fell once again. And that's now down to levels comparable with those other periods when the overall index was quite weak. So that's pretty much reflecting the overall index, whereas that outlook for personal finances is moving in a different direction to the overall index.
Now, you mentioned consumer spending, which is still going okay because people still have savings. But what about the biggest investment for most of us of the lot, which is housing? How are people feeling about buying property?
That has really deteriorated once again by about 3%. So that's now at its lowest level. The term is now a good time to buy a dwelling. That's now at its lowest level since the financial crisis in 2008. The factors there, I believe, are affordability and rising interest rates. So affordability had been weighing on that index for some time. It peaked actually in November 2020. But the combination of very high prices and now rising interest rates has really put a spike, a downward spike in that sentiment index. The other one that we look at to give us a feel for what's going to be happening in the housing market is the outlook for house prices. And that index fell by 8.4%. It's now at 111. So that still means that there's more people expecting house prices to increase than people expecting them to fall. But I expect that index to start heading into the low 100 territory pretty soon. And indeed, in New South Wales and Victoria, it's hovering just above 100. It fell by more than the 8.4%. So I think probably next month we'll see more people expecting falls and rises in the two big states, whereas in Queensland there's still a high degree of optimism. The index is 125. It actually rose by 3%. So you are seeing different confidence levels in different markets across the country.
What about our appetite for risk, which I suppose most of us tend to be fairly risk-averse, but is that something you're able to measure as well?
Yes, well, we asked them what's the wisest place for your savings, and we found that that proportion now is only slightly below the proportion we saw in the global financial crisis. So this is a proportion of people who favour low-risk investments, such as capital-protected bank deposits or actually pay down debt. So bottom line is that the level of risk aversion at the moment is as high as we've seen for 15 years.
So these all, as we talked about at the beginning, all add up to a number. But I'm wondering if you could unpack how important consumer sentiment is, how much it shapes our economy.
Oh, look, I think in the longer term, it's very, very important. As I said, at the moment, I don't think it's signalling a sharp slowdown in spending because of these unusual other factors. But what it's telling me is that by the end of the year, we're going to see a much more downbeat pace for consumer spending. And 2023 will be the year in which the growth in the economy will slump significantly. We're looking at 2% growth, down from 4% this year. And a lot of that will be driven by a slowdown in consumer spending from around 6 this year, with the momentum I'm expecting down to a below trend 2.5%. So I think the sentiment numbers are the first indicators that this is going to happen. And then, of course, some of the other factors, such as further increases in interest rates, further falls in house prices, will certainly ensure that that's the outcome that I'm expecting next year.
So an early indicator. And you've touched on this already, Bill, but what does this tell you about what the RBA ought to do next?
Look, they're now focused on inflation. I've just been listening to the press conference of Chair Powell, who raised rates by 75 basis points this morning. And it's all about we have to get inflation down. It's non-negotiable. And really thinking in terms of, well, if the cost to the economy is greater than we expect, then so be it. But our number one objective is to bring down inflation. So you've got a central banker in Australia now who's lifted his inflation forecast between forecast meetings, which is unusual, to 7% by the end of the year. The Federal Reserve is only expecting 5.2% of inflation by the end of the year. So you've really got a situation where the RBA is now lifting its concern around the inflation risk. And that's why we think they'll do another 50 basis points in July.
Bill Evans is Westpac's chief economist. This is The Money on RN and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Adey.
The United States is mourning the loss of at least 19 primary school children and two adults killed in the country's latest mass shooting. The children at Robb Elementary School in the state of Texas were 2 days away.
Police and paramedics rush towards the sound of gunshots at Robb Elementary School. As parents desperately sought information about their own children.
In the last 10 days, we've had elderly black people killed in a supermarket in Buffalo. We've had Asian churchgoers killed in Southern California. And now we have children murdered at school. When are we going to do something?
The aftermath of the mass shooting in Texas last month. We've become horribly used to reports of gun violence from America. Nearly 20,000 people have died so far this year. Nearly 17,000 have been injured. The impact of this is overwhelming, and we also know the cost. It's half a trillion US dollars a year. Actually, $557 billion. And we know this because of the work of Ted Miller of the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation, an independent non-profit that studies public health, education and safety. Ted, what goes into that figure?
Well, there's the medical care, not only of the injury when it first happens, but the lifetime of medical care that can follow, for example, a traumatic brain injury or spinal cord injury. There's mental health care for the victim and the victim's family. There's things like emergency transport, emergency medical, police, and assaults and homicides. There's the whole criminal justice side where we look at what's happening in the courts, what's happening in the incarceration system and in the prison and parole system. And finally, there are the costs to employers. Then there's the value of life, which we break into the work loss, both wage work and household work. If you're killed, you lose a lifetime of work loss. Mm. And the value that we place on quality of life. And those two together are about $10.5 million a life, though we adjust that down a little bit because the average homicide victim, for example, has below average earnings.
Okay, so from what you're saying, this is a total bill for taxpayers, survivors, their families, employers and communities, and you're looking at both the direct costs and the indirect costs, which I suspect will be bigger. So can we start with the direct costs? This is primarily, I guess, what the government pays through the taxpayer. What's included in that chunk of it?
Yeah. I want to add one thing before we go there. When you said and community, actually the community costs are not in there. I don't have data on the effects of gun violence on property values, the effects on community integrity, and I don't have the cost of just people being afraid because somebody was shot by a bullet that came through the wall of their house because there was a mass shooting and now everybody's afraid to go out on the street.
Right.
And those costs are not in my costs.
But they're pretty real all the same. All right. Well, let's go on with the direct costs, which, as we were talking about before, this is what the government pays through the taxpayer. What's included in those?
Direct costs are the things that come out of our pocket. They're those emergency services. They're the criminal justice costs. They're the medical and mental health care costs. Some of the employer costs, those are all direct costs. Now, government pays many of the direct costs, but not all. In the United States, some of the medical costs will be paid by the government. In fact, for firearm injuries, most of them will. But some of them will be paid by private insurance. Some of them will even be paid out of pocket by people who were shot. On the other side, the government does have some income transfer programs for people who are severely and permanently disabled. And so the government will pick up some of those indirect wage losses as well.
Well, let's talk a bit about the indirect costs, because they are the bulk of this. Can you just walk me through what's included in indirect costs?
The indirect costs are the value that we place on our lives. And the way we measure that is by looking at how much people routinely pay for small changes in their chance of being killed and injured. For example, people who work in risky occupations get higher wages. People buy things like bicycle helmets and airbags, and we know how many people bought them before they were required and what they paid for them. So we can infer how they valued their lives. We then break that down into the work loss, because we can tell you how much your lifetime earnings are. And the remainder is the value of the quality of life that you lost.
What is that figure again?
The total is currently $11.2 million per firearm death. And of that, $10.3 million is the quality of life.
Mm. Now, you touched on this earlier, Ted, but the losses to employers, do you actually have a figure for how much that costs?
It varies depending on what's happened, but typically a fatality costs an employer about $11,000. And some of that is that the employers pay for things like life insurance. They'll also have to go hire and train a new employee. And that's the cost of hiring somebody. What I don't have separated out is the sick leave costs that employers incur when their employees are injured.
Yeah, in the 2018 figures, I think the total cost per year to employers is about $500 million, $528.7 million per year.
Yeah, and when you say that, as I say, there's two kinds of things that are in cost to employers. That $500 million, and it's $535 million in 2019, excludes any sick leave payments that they make.
Yeah.
It's the direct costs of substituting for that worker, of other workers being distracted, of perhaps that worker having unique skills. That was the brewmaster at our brewery. His taste buds aren't quite replaceable. That's part of that $535 million.
All right. So the cost per taxpayer, and I think the figure is something like $14 billion. Of course, across America, that's not huge per taxpayer, but it depends on the state you live in, apparently, and I didn't know that. So Louisiana is apparently where taxpayers pay the most.
Yes, and that's because they have the worst firearm injury problem, and they're always up there in the top four or five, it seems. They're in a part of the United States where firearm laws are lax. But you have to remember that 43% of people in America own a gun, and the average household with guns owns more than seven guns. We have more guns than people in this country, which is just sort of a little bit crazy. And the cost of firearm injuries is $1,700 a gun a year.
It's staggering. When we think of this, and especially for in our part of the world where there's a terrible news story about another mass shooting in America, we tend to associate it with someone using a gun against others. But actually, suicide by guns is a high proportion, isn't it, of the gun violence statistics in your country. And that must affect the costings too.
Yes, it is a large piece of it. And one of the interesting things that we've learned through research is that your chance of dying by suicide and your chance of dying by homicide are both much higher if you have a gun in your home.
Yeah. It makes sense. Thank you very much for joining us today on The Money.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Ted Miller is at the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation. Now to some very expensive lettuces. If you're on any social media, you'll have seen the pictures. $10 a head, $11.99 I saw the other day. And the boomer jokes have started too. If young people want to buy houses, they should give up salad rolls. But how did it get to this? Flavio Macau can tell you. The associate professor at Edith Cowan University is an expert on supply chains and logistics.
Well, most definitely, lettuce prices are higher across Australia. And if you get Queensland and New South Wales, oh boy, it is skyrocketing. You have some people on Twitter, and they are posting photos of iceberg lettuce for as high as $10 or $11.99. And it's well above the more usual $2.80. So we can say that the new normal is around, let's say, $5. So yes, it is a lot more expensive. And let me say, it's not exactly new, and it's not only lettuce. You will see that increase in prices in many fresh produce. And also, the price has been going up for a long time. The peak body for Australian vegetable products, AusVeg, they say that between 2006 and 2016, costs and most likely prices more than double.
So can I get you to kind of walk me through the costs? Because there's going to be different components. If we start with transport, that's obviously one that's going to be important.
Yeah, so transport, it's very important when you think about fresh produce. And some of what's happening now is about the situation in Ukraine, because most of the fresh vegetables are moved by truck, and they are very sensitive to diesel prices. And with Russia's invasion, diesel prices went up, up, up. There is a research from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and they found that a $1 increase in diesel price leads to an increase in wholesale prices for fresh vegetables from 20 to 28%. And if you take in Australia, diesel prices climbed from $1.30 a liter to about $2.10 a liter in the past year. So that will definitely have an effect. And also, the average trip distance in Australia is almost as 2 times longer than what you got in the US. So that explains prices going up as well.
What else will feed in here, Flavio?
Well, we have the price of fertilizers, and again, the impact of the war. Fertilizers account for about 10% of the cost of growing vegetables. And Austrade reports that through last year, the price of urea, which is a key ingredient in fertilizers, climbed from about $250 a ton to $1,000 a ton. And if you get other fertilizers like phosphate and potassium, prices more than double as well. So that will have an effect in costs and then an impact in prices.
Absolutely. What about the cost of labor?
Well, the most important cost in farming is labor. It accounts for about a quarter of the total cash costs, and it has been hit in two ways. First, on April 28, the Fair Work Commission, they changed the horticultural award to guarantee farm workers a minimum rate of pay. So that's something that those farm workers were not entitled before. It is fair, it is important, but the timing is not great. And then second, agriculture is facing a labor shortage. You have fewer foreign workers as they have been denied entry in Australia for almost 2 years. And also those workers that you get, they have been hit by COVID, especially in the last few months. So in a way, you have to pay a little bit more for them. And it has been harder to find people to work in the farms.
I hate to use the phrase perfect storm. I think it's overused. But none of these things that you've mentioned are going to change very quickly.
Oh, they will not, because transport, fertilizers, labor, they all point to a more permanent step up in prices. And I don't see much relief in sight. So you may expect that the traditional $2.80 for a lettuce will now be the new normal of about $5 per iceberg.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Is that all of it? The entire head of the lettuce, so to speak?
Oh, no. Actually, there's a little bit more. To get prices as high as $11.99 per iceberg, there is one more factor, which is the weather. So when you think about climate change, it's not only about global warming, but it's also about the extreme events happening more often, like bushfires and frosts and droughts. And you have more recently, you know, the extreme floods across New South Wales and Queensland, and those floods hit the farmers really hard. So if you think that extreme weather is more common than before, we will see more increases due to climate change to price of fresh vegetable and other produce. Because, you know, what was once in a century event, now it's happening kind of every couple of years.
Yeah, in fact, places like Lismore have been hit, you know, twice, once in a century event within 5 or 6 weeks. So we can see that we're going to have to rethink what once in a century means. And climate change is not going to be fixed quickly. Is this just how things are going to be?
Well, pretty much, yes. What we can do is help fix climate change as much as we can. So Australia can act with more determination to slow the pace of climate change. But that's a long battle. And there are things that we can do for the next couple of years. And one example is to change somehow the way we grow some of our vegetables. And take hydroponic farming as an example. This is thriving in Europe, especially in Spain. And with just 8,000 square meters of vertical hydroponic farm, you can produce as many as 15 million lettuce per year, and that in a more controlled environment, which is less affected by those extreme weather events. If you can locate those farms close to clean energy sources like wind farms, as Sundrop Farm is near Port Augusta in South Australia, you can drop costs. If you can locate those hydroponic warehouses to produce your vegetables close to cities, transportation costs will go down as well. So in these controlled environments, they are easier to set up automation, and they are not subject to the seasons of the year. You can cut produce times by half for some vegetables and get up to 13 growth cycles a year. So that is part of the solution.
You're right about Spain. I remember seeing a TV documentary a year or so ago, and it just showed, you know, just hectares and hectares and hectares of glasshouses in Spain growing all manner of things and really being very important for the salad vegetables and other things for all of Europe. Is there anything else that someone listening now can do if they don't want to spend a fortune on a lettuce?
Well, what you can do is the usual shop around, because different supermarkets will have different suppliers. We work with different farmers from different locations and will be affected in different ways. So you may find a better price if you do a little bit more of research. And every time you buy local, you're helping farmers to stay in the business. And they have now these boxes of vegetables, which are quite handy. So those things can help. And if it gets to the extreme point where you're paying $12 a lettuce, think about switching vegetables, at least for a while, because not all of them are in prices at the same time in the same way.
Yeah, actually, there was a news story, I think, last week about how Kentucky Fried Chicken are using cabbage instead of lettuce in some of their offerings. I wouldn't know, but apparently it's true.
Yeah, you have KFC and you have Subway as well, so you have this mix of cabbage and lettuce coming on.
Well, on that interesting culinary note, I think we'll wrap things up. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And, of course, the late news on cabbage might mean that KFC have to find another approach. That was Associate Professor Flavio Macau from Edith Cowan University. That's it for The Money. Thanks to producer Kate McDonald, sound engineer Tegan Nichols. I'm Richard Adie.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.